Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to try and get through a couple of questions, quick-fire questions, as it were, from some listeners. Just a reminder, we really enjoy reading everything that you send to us. And as you can listen, you can hear that they're often used as the basis of our episodes. So please do keep sending in thoughts and questions or links to news stories you've seen which you'd like us to respond to. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.co. Sorry, premier.org.uk. This question comes from a listener called Ben, and he says, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the ongoing case in Georgia of a 21 weeks pregnant woman who was sadly declared brainstem dead due to blood clots in her brain. However, doctors have said that they cannot turn off her ventilator as this would violate the state's strict anti-abortion laws, which give fetuses legal personhood. This is apparently against the wishes of the family, who would like the ventilator switched off. I instinctively feel that keeping a brain-dead body ventilated for several months in order to deliver a viable baby is rather dystopian, and it seems to me that turning off the ventilator does not quite count as an abortion, as they're not intending to end the fetus's life. However, if the woman was 38 weeks pregnant instead of 21, I think it would be right and reasonable to keep her ventilated for a few hours or even a day or two in order to deliver the baby. Does the fact that we're talking about months rather than hours change the morality? Also, we routinely keep brain-dead bodies ventilated for hours or even days in order to save the lives of other people through organ transplantation. Is this morally different to doing it for a fetus? As you can see, I'm quite conflicted about this and would love to hear your thoughts. Have you kept it up to speed with this story in the United States?
Well, I've been aware of it. And it's not that unusual. There've been a whole number of cases like this, but I think what's rather different is, so in general, what would happen in a case like this is, certainly if this happened in the UK, is there would be a sort of detailed discussion between the clinicians involved and the family and the parents, the relatives of the woman who was tragically severely brain damaged or brain dead, and particularly, of course, close relatives, the husband, and so on. Their views would be taken very much into account, and the idea would be to come to some consensus of balancing. And the way the law works in the UK is primarily by balancing risks and benefits. And so the kind of analysis that would go on here is that what are all the risks and damaging effects of carrying on life support versus the potential benefits. Now, obviously, that's an extremely complex issue. But I think in a case of a 21-week pregnant woman, I suspect that in the majority of cases in the UK, a decision would be taken that the right thing to do was to switch off the ventilator with the recognition that this would lead tragically to the death of the unborn baby, of the fetus. But clearly the situation in the US state of Georgia is different. The law is different. And do you want to just sort of say a bit about that?
Let me just give a bit of background, because what is fascinating is that this story hit the headlines in May, which is when... So the woman in question is called Adriana Smith. It hit the headlines in May when Adriana's parents, her family, basically went to the media and disclosed this story themselves. And that was a point when Adriana was 21 weeks gestation, pregnant. But she has actually had her medical emergency, the blood clots in her brain, was back in February when she was only at 9 weeks gestation. And so by the point this hit the news, she had already been kept in life support for 3 months while her child grew within her, despite being diagnosed as brain dead. And to jump to the end, the following month in June, there was an emergency cesarean section, and Adriana's baby, who was named Chance, was born alive, weighing just 1 pound 13 ounces, which is very premature. I mean, how many weeks is that? I think it's about 6 months.
Something like that, 28 weeks, 800 grams.
Yeah, very, very, very small, but alive and is expected to do okay. And Adriana was taken off life support a few days later and allowed to die in June. Yes, you're right. At 21 weeks, it's kind of in the balance. But as you say, probably most medical practice in this country would be to not do it. But to start life support at 9 weeks gestation, am I right in saying, would be absolutely unthought of, unprecedented in most jurisdictions?
No, I think that's right. It would. And it's extraordinary that it's possible to keep a person's body with catastrophic brain damage alive by using intensive care for months. I mean, you know, just as an intensive care doctor, I find that absolutely extraordinary, because of the multiple problems and that you have to overcome, just physiological issues. So just at a very technical level, at an expense level, I mean, this will have cost literally millions of dollars, and so on and so on. But it's all because of the law, isn't it? That the law states, yes. I think the doctors were clearly very afraid that they would be accused of a criminal offence if they were to switch off the life support machinery.
Yes. So this the law in question is known as the Living Infants Fairness and Equality Act, or the LIFE Act. And it was passed by the Georgia House of Representatives in 2019. At this point, it was deemed to be unconstitutional because it clashed with Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court ruling, which decreed that in the first trimester, women had a constitutional right to an abortion. However, as we all know, in 2022, Roe versus Wade was overturned by the Supreme Court. And at that point, various states that had so-called trigger bans, so that was kind of abortion bans on their books that were just held in abeyance until Roe versus Wade was cleared out of the way, and then they would immediately come into effect. Georgia's LIFE Act is one of these. So the LIFE Act says that abortions are illegal once a fetal heartbeat has been detected, which in practice is about 6 weeks of gestation. And there are the only exceptions to this would be in cases of rape or incest, or if the pregnancy was non-viable or would threaten the life of the mother. So it's, in American terms, quite a strict anti-abortion act, which in practice, given 6 weeks is so early that many women aren't actually aware that they're pregnant at that point, is in effect a almost total abortion ban. And not only that, as the question notes, it is being interpreted to give a form of personhood to the fetus. And so it doesn't just make kind of active abortions illegal. It has raised questions or concerns from some medical professionals that certain medical procedures might bring them within the ambit of the law. Hence, the doctors in this case decided, despite the wishes of the family, to turn off Adriana's life support and allow her to die, and knowing that that would also cause the death of the baby growing inside her womb, the doctors decided that they were compelled by the Life Act, because the fetus has some sort of legal personhood, to keep Adriana alive, well, keep her womb working until they could do a C-section when the baby Chance was old enough.
Yeah, there are a whole number of interesting and problematic aspects, aren't there, of this kind of case. I mean, one of the things just in the whole background is the extraordinary situation in the USA at the moment, and that is where you have states sometimes adjacent to one another who have totally contradictory laws about abortion, and therefore the way that doctors have to respond, because the states have jurisdiction over their own practitioners, including their doctors and so on, it's very much depends on which particular state you happen to be born in, where you happen to live, whether you can get across a border into another jurisdiction, and so on and so on. Which again, looking across from the UK, seems like an extraordinary phenomenon. Although this is part of the USA, isn't it? The USA has always had this patchwork of different states.
Yes, it has. And that's, as you say, kind of fundamental to the kind of history of how the country was formed, is this patchwork of very kind of localized, devolved government. And that's why the only way the kind of pro-abortion side could legalize abortion across all 50 states was to take it to the constitutional level. You know, that's the kind of document that all the states have to subordinate their own local regulations and rules to, ultimately. And that's why Roe versus Wade came about. It was a test case proposed in the 1960s, I think, possibly the early 70s, by pro-abortion activists who sought to use the individual story of one woman who was not able to get an abortion because of her local state's rules to establish a constitutional right to an abortion, which has now been revoked. So yes, with the absence of that, of the Roe versus Wade constitutional decision, it rolls back to the 50 states to decide in their own way. And, you know, there is an enormous variety between states that have very liberal abortion regimes and states that have almost or total abortion bans, as you say, sometimes side by side.
That's right. And another background effect in all this, of course, is the astonishingly advances in medical treatment, and just the fact that it's technically possible to keep a brain dead person's body alive for months in an intensive care unit. I mean, it was inconceivable decades ago, but now, as medical science advances, it creates all these desperately difficult, challenging decisions which simply were not there before, and this is a classic example of that. And it's, of course, there are deep philosophical and theological, spiritual issues here, and I think we've talked previously on several podcasts about Christians' attitudes to abortion. And the idea that the unborn baby has a unique significance and role, is an actor on the stage, that is something which is strongly supported in biblical Christian thinking. But once you treat the unborn baby as though it was a child, it has all sorts of unforeseen consequences, because this being in the womb is utterly and totally dependent on the moment-to-moment bodily support of the mother. And the inevitable effect of this kind of perspective, where you give legal rights to the fetus, is tragically you end up with a kind of legal battle between the fetus and the mother. As we previously had on this podcast, I'm thinking of Dawn McAvoy, whose whole argument, which I strongly support, is that both lives matter and that the interests of the mother are nearly always are the same as the interests of the unborn baby. And rather than to see, as so often in the pro-life, pro-choice debates, it's the interests of the mother versus the interests of the fetus. The two are seen as combatants fighting for their rights, which is such a distorted understanding of pregnancy, where the best interests of the mother are the same as the best interests of the fetus. So the unfortunate thing about this particular case is it's a classic example where the interests of the mother and the interests of the baby seem to be in direct opposition. I mean, a much more common problem is what happens if the mother's lifestyle is damaging the fetus? Because, you know, legally, can the mother be allowed to take on actions which might damage her unborn baby? And so should she be allowed to drink? Should she be allowed to go on holidays where she might cause the accidental miscarriage or and so on and so on and so on? And there have been cases where mothers have been imprisoned during pregnancy to prevent them from drinking alcohol, and that's to protect the life of the fetus. So
really? It's for various... In this country? Yeah,
not in this country, but in the States. in certain states that have a very strong fetal protection law. And so it's for considerations like this that the UK judges have always hesitated in recognising the legal rights of the fetus until the moment of birth, because of these kind of unforeseen consequences. And this case seems to me a classic example of an unforeseen consequence.
Yes, it reminds me very strongly of a conversation we had on the podcast several years ago, which was also in a different state in America, but one which had also introduced some kind of language which appeared to give the fetus a sort of legal personhood. And this time it was in relation to IVF, and it was where an IVF clinic had accidentally or had kind of lacked security, and someone, not one of the staff or the doctors, but someone else, had just wandered into the deep freeze bit where the embryos are being stored, frozen in stasis, and they had accidentally basically dislodged or dropped something. And the result was that some embryos had thawed out and therefore died or were destroyed, whatever language you want to use. And the question was, could the IVF clinic be sued under existing legislation in that state, which made people responsible for paying compensation if they kind of, you know, had a mishap which caused the death or injury of a child? And the Supreme Court of that state said, yes, you know, your abortion laws give fetuses a sort of legal personhood, and therefore, and then suddenly all the IVF clinics suddenly had to pause because they were like, oh, hold on. Well, that means that the law believes that we are freezing legal children, sometimes for decades at a time, before then re-implanting them into wombs. Or let's be honest, most embryos frozen in IVF are never re-implanted and they are stored until they're eventually destroyed. Is that suddenly, are we now running some kind of dystopian murder factory in the eyes of the law of this state? And that was, again, none of the Christians, many of them Christians who wrote these laws, had any intention to prohibit IVF, or most of them didn't. And yet when you do what seems obvious to some pro-life Christians, to say life begins at conception and a 1-week-old fetus is equal in rights and status to you or I, as you say, it ripples through with these unforeseen consequences.
Yeah, as I've reflected about this, I think one of the the critical points, and I think we've talked about this before, is that as long as the unborn baby is inside the body of the mother, there's absolutely nothing that we as a society can do to care for that unborn baby. We can't give it any kind of medication. We can't give it any kind of treatment without invading the body of the mother. And so it's almost as though the unborn child is a hostage within the body of the mother. And any attempt that society has, even if society wishes to preserve the life of that being in the womb, it has to invade the body of the mother. And the most dramatic examples of this are where rare cases where a baby at term is in great risk of dying because of problems in the womb, and the only solution is to perform an emergency cesarean section to allow the baby to be delivered at operation. But the mother refuses for some reason. Sometimes it's because they have a morbid fear of hospitals, of needles, injections, and so on. And there have been legal challenges about what must we do in that case? What is the right thing for society? Society wishes to ensure that the baby survives, and society wishes to protect the rights of the mother and not to coerce her if she genuinely withholds her consent. How do you solve that conundrum? And time and again, there have been several cases, the UK judges have absolutely concluded that the wishes of the mother, provided that she is competent legally to refuse treatment, the medical staff are not permitted to effectively hold her down and drag her kicking and screaming into the operating theatre. And you can see why. You can see how traumatic that would be for all concerned, like a police state, you know, when the security guards are called.
Yeah. There's a very dark history, isn't there, of governments using medical doctors to, you know, perform operations and other things on unwilling patients. And it's, you know, it's what, it's, you know, to be blunt, it's what happens in concentration camps and in Soviet gulags.
And we don't wish to belong to a society that does that, that calls the SWAT team into the hospital and so on. So that it's understandable why judges say no, that even if tragically that results in the death of the fetus, we will not do that. Now, once the baby is born, even if they're only 5 minutes old, the situation is totally different. We can now act in the best interest of the baby without in any way invading the body of the mother. And therefore, the balance changes. At that point, once the baby's born, we as a society and I as a paediatrician, you know, used to have a duty of care to that baby, to act in the baby's best interest. So this is why pregnancy is a uniquely complex and problematic ethical area. And so if you were to give legal personhood to the fetus, then yes, there would be a conflict between the two people, and in that case, I think you would be justified in calling the police and taking them forcefully operating on the mother. The UK law has always held back from that.
And I suppose in this Georgia case, what has effectively happened is that Adriana Smith, being brain dead, could not resist the coercion of the hospital and the state, because she, and therefore her womb was, you know, to be provocative, her womb was kind of commandeered by the state, which decided that the interests of the fetus outweighed her own interests. And the state kept her artificially alive kept her body artificially alive for four further months in order for the baby to be born alive. Now, some Christians would say that, you know what, she was brain dead. She was not suffering as a result of being kept on life support. She didn't have any consciousness. So what was lost. We might say, yes, we don't want to try and coerce active women against their consent from doing things if they decide tragically they no longer want to support the life of the child inside their body. But Adriana was unconscious, brain dead even. So what was the harm here?
Yeah, and you know, I think if you take a very sort of utilitarian approach, you could argue that but of course it's not just an individual. One has to think of these decisions in the whole round. You have to think of all the people who are involved.
Mm.
You think of all her family and relatives who, instead of being able to grieve and the loss of their, you know, of this young woman, are forced to visit her every day and see this breathing body, unresponsive. There are so many people involved that there is the vast amount of medical resources, certainly in most places across the world. I think this probably isn't true in the States, where there is an absolute excess of intensive care beds. But in most places, if you had somebody in an intensive care cot for months and months and months, not only is it costing vast amount of resources, vast amount of nurse and medical and hospital time, but it's also preventing intensive care being that bed being used for other people who need it. You know, so there are all kinds of knock-on effects in these decisions. These decisions are not just an isolated woman and an isolated baby. And I think to be fair to the doctors, that I suspect, reading between the lines, none of the doctors and staff, or very few of them, were doing this with any kind of
relish
or agreement. Even they felt they had no choice. They were being compelled against their will to take actions which they may well have found abhorrent. I mean, the you know, to go on months after months. I think particularly about the intensive care nurses, who are the people who are spending hours and hours at the side of this woman and her baby.
Wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight, and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your ebook today. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And this often happens where abortion laws are often written by people who aren't massively proficient in medicine, and often intersect in ways which the medical professionals find themselves in impossible situations. I'm thinking of, you must know about the case in Ireland of Savita Halappanavar. So she was Ireland for a long time had a constitutional prohibition on abortion due to its kind of history as a Catholic country, but in 2012, so this woman called Savita, I'm sorry, I'm probably mispronouncing her surname, Halappanavar, who was originally from India but living in Ireland, she was 17 weeks pregnant. Came into hospital complaining of back pain and lower pressure, and found that her gestational sac was protruding from her cervix. She was admitted to hospital, and it was determined that miscarriage was unavoidable. Several hours later, her waters broke but did not expel the fetus. The following day, she requested with her doctor if she could have an abortion, but was refused because Irish law at the time forbade abortion if a fetal heartbeat was still present. And then she later developed sepsis and died a few days later. And this was a pivotal case in kind of shifting attitudes in Ireland and ultimately paved the way for an eventual referendum which overturned the constitutional prohibition on abortion and allowed abortion for the first time. And it was highly contested by both sides as to what extent the laws, what was it, medical misadventure, or was it, you know, laws preventing? But it's another example of how you can write something that seems quite straightforward. We don't do abortions in this country. And it actually went intersects with the messy realities of the kind of edge cases, the grey area between life and death, mother, child, the myriad of things that can go horribly wrong in the 40 weeks of a pregnancy. It's often leaves left to the doctors quite unsure what they are allowed or not allowed to do.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that particular case, as you say, was very contested. And I think many people looking in from outside said it was gross medical mismanagement, which was then taken as a, you know, it was very advantageous to campaigners.
Yes.
Who made the most of it. But nonetheless, you are right. And I think that doctors, to this extent, you know, quite rightly are subject to the law of the land, but when the law of the land seems to intersect in a way, in an unexpected way, and makes it very, very difficult for doctors to make these snap decisions. And of course, if they get it wrong and they're then prosecuted, it could well be the end of their professional careers. They could go to prison. They could be subject to enormous fines and so on. So there are extraordinary risks, and I think you're right that campaigners sometimes seem to us, those who work in the medical professions, that they live in a kind of alternative reality which doesn't reflect the messy nature of clinical practice. That doesn't mean that there aren't rules. It doesn't mean there aren't principles. But the fundamental principles is that they must be applied with judgment, with care, with compassion, and particularly individualized to each individual case.
Mm. Just to returning quickly to Ben's original question, he says, and I think I probably share his view, that if Adriana had been, say, 38 weeks pregnant instead of 9 weeks pregnant when she lost her life, he says, I think it would be reasonable for the doctors to keep her alive for a few more days or a week at max to then deliver the child inside her. Do you agree that the duration here is part of the issue? Or, you know, is it reasonable to say, look, she was due to give birth imminently, let's just keep her alive on a ventilator for a few more days to get our ducks in a row and do a C-section? We don't have to wait 4 or 5 months. That seems to be too far.
Yes. I mean, actually, medically, if this happened, yes, at 38,
you could do it anyway.
You could deliver immediately. I mean, there'd be no point in waiting any time at all. You would keep the body alive literally for a few hours at the most and deliver the baby. So the whole problem comes when these things happen very early on in pregnancy. Even at 28 weeks gestation, it's possible to deliver babies very rapidly, and in that case, the majority of those babies will survive. So what is unique about this, or very unusual about this case, is the very early stage of pregnancy. And I think that does completely change the balance of risks and benefits.
What if the family still remained hostile to the idea of life support after brain death? So let's imagine a hypothetical situation where the mother was, let's say, right on the cusp, 23 weeks, 22 weeks pregnant. You know, there have been babies who have been born at 22 weeks and survived, but it's extreme and it's difficult. And if you could keep them alive for another, just another week or so would make a difference. But the parent, but the family of the woman say, no, we don't want you to keep this baby alive, even though we're aware it will end the life of the fetus. Do you think there is ever a case, if it is much shorter span of time, to do this? If it is, well, on the grey area of viability?
I mean, these are the kind of edge cases, which, as you said, you know, they happen and they're grey and they're difficult. And what would happen in the UK in that situation, if there was a complete difference of opinion between the clinical team and the parents or the, you know, the relatives, is that this would go to a formal legal proceedings. These things can be held very rapidly. They can be held within hours, if necessary, in the UK jurisdiction. And the case would be argued in open court. Well, not necessarily open in the sense that with the glare of the media, but it would be discussed in detail. One of the fascinating things about the UK system is that there's someone called the official solicitor who is instructed by the courts to defend the rights of the child. In this case, there would be a legal team.
There'd be three legal teams, one for the doctors, one for the mother, and one for the child.
And that, I think, is actually a very good and just solution. There would be a legal team arguing the case for the unborn baby, and to make sure that all the arguments were aired, and in the end, a judge would have to, you know, take the judgment of Solomon and come to a decision. And I think that's the best way we have, with all its fallen nature and impartial information and inability to see the future. I personally think that's the best mechanism we have for solving these kind of tragic and painful and difficult disputes.
And just a final one then. The other element we haven't really discussed is the whole concept of brain death and the fact that you can keep someone who is kind of dead alive, or kind of alive, through modern intensive care and ventilation is in itself a quite relatively recently modern development. It goes back maybe 50 years. And as we discussed at more length in the previous episode about the very sad case of Archie Battersby, so many of these legal disputes that you've just sketched out, you know, in the UK, we've had a lot of them where parents and medical teams are kind of at odds over a very sick child, where a lot of these are basically ethical dilemmas that can only exist because we have this concept of brain death, which is a very morally ambiguous and difficult to understand from a kind of spiritual ethical perspective. What do we think of as Christians? Is someone who is brain dead still alive? Are they a kind of animated corpse? It's all very murky and messy, even before there's another life growing inside that body.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And the whole concept of brain death is highly contested. It's been increasingly challenged by a number of philosophers, including Christian philosophers and theologians. And they would want to argue that this woman is not dead in any recognizable sense. Her heart is beating. She's pink. And biologically, her body is alive. She's alive with very, very catastrophically severe and irreversible brain damage. But we shouldn't regard her as a breathing corpse. In this particular case, would it have made any difference if this woman had catastrophically severe brain injury, but was being kept alive by a ventilator? I think in the UK, there would still be the discussion, is this in her best interests? She's not showing any signs of recovery. If we switched off the life support, she would die. We are able to keep her alive with catastrophically severe brain injury. Is there a point where we say enough is enough? And with everyone's agreement, we switch off the life support system, again, knowing that this means that her unborn baby would die. So I'm not sure that it actually makes a huge difference in this case as to whether technically she is brain dead, or whether she is alive but with catastrophic and irreversible and terminal brain injury.
Mm. In some sense, is brain death a kind of paper diagnosis? And not, you know, it's kind of, it's not something you can necessarily say, look, QED, this person is brain dead. It's more a judgment doctors come when they examine the consequences of someone who has very, very severe brain damage. Or is there a fuzzy line between being so brain damaged that you can only be kept alive on a ventilator and being brain dead?
I mean, from a technical neurological point of view, there is a difference. And the difference is that there is no activity above the brainstem at all.
Right.
And there are various tests which it is argued recovery has never occurred. But it is a highly contested area. And philosophically, I mean, of course, it's really, its primary issue is to do with transplantation.
Yeah, well, that's what our questioner mentioned. You know, is that right that it's sometimes not at all unusual for people who are brain dead to have their bodies kept ventilated so that we can bring a transplant team in and do an organ transplant?
That's exactly right. And there's something called the dead donor rule, which says that you can't transplant organs from somebody while they're still alive. You can't transplant somebody's heart while they're still alive. You can't transplant somebody's kidneys or their liver while they're still alive. And therefore, the dead donor rule says that, well, they're legally dead. Okay, they're still pink, they're breathing on a ventilator, but they're legally dead. That means that we can follow the dead donor rule now. Now we can transplant their organs. So, like, again, this is highly contested. And, you know, the practical situation, Tim, is do you want to carry a donor card in your wallet that says, you know, if you're involved in some catastrophic road accident and are deemed brain dead but are still alive, would you wish your organs to be transplanted? Or would you wish to be certified dead, which means your heart has stopped, before? And again, I think this is, people come to different conclusions.
Hmm. I can see the merit in saying what we don't want is for the active transplant to be the cause of death. So we don't want the fact that you know, to be brutal, you opened my chest up and took my heart out of my body to be the actual thing that tipped me over the line from very soon dead to dead. Even if my death was inevitable otherwise, I can see that philosophically and morally it's unpalatable to say that it was the act of transplanting that caused the death. But I don't see personally any issue with saying, right, we know this person is a donor. We know there's someone on the other side of the country who needs that liver, that heart, those lungs. If we let this person go off life support and die right now, that organ will degrade and won't be transplantable. So let's keep them alive for 24 hours while we rush the recipient down from the other part of the country, get them in two beds side by side. Then you turn off my life support, you let me die, and seconds later, after my heart stopped beating, you whip it out while it's still fresh and transplant it. That, for me, seems morally unproblematic and something that me, as a signed up organ donor, would be very delighted that my body could be a gift to someone else, to give life to someone else in that way.
Well, as you can see why somebody would think, yeah, but hang on a minute, the state's desperate for your organs. And yeah, okay, Tim, he's got very bad brain damage. He might be showing a bit of signs of recovery, but you know what? You know, we really need that organ. That's the kind.
Yeah, well, it comes down to trust. And at the moment, I feel confident that I could trust NHS medical professionals not to hasten my death in order to liberate my organs. But there may be different states and different places and different people who aren't able to offer that trust, and I can understand that.
That's right. And again, there are these terrible memories of state-coerced abuse of medical technologies, which all these discussions are clouded by that, aren't they? They're clouded by memories which go back you know, not just to the Nazis, but also to Stalin and the Russians. And
it's happened in China, forced transplantation of prisoners and things like that.
And so I think, you know, it's just important to remember these are human beings that we're talking about. Yes, these are complex, desperately challenging medical and ethical and philosophical decisions. And yet there are real people here who bleed and suffer and die. Yeah. And you think of this child gradually learning what happened and so why they and the relatives and how will the relatives respond to this child and so on and so on. So there are immense complexities here. And sometimes we just have to do the best we can whilst recognizing that our understanding is deeply limited and flawed.
Yes, I think that's really wise. And I think it's really important, and I'm guilty of this at times, that we don't, having these fascinating medical ethics discoveries, reduce human beings to just being kind of component bits. You know, a mother, Adriana Smith, is more than just her womb. She's not just a vessel and a carrier for her baby, but she is an entire embodied human being, or was an entire embodied human being, a precious image bearer of God. And like similarly, you know, donors, organ donors, are not just scaffolding for their hearts and their lungs, but they're whole holistic beings. And just because we can chop and change, and with this amazing technology we have, take bits out of some people and use people's bodies in ways we'd never expected, you know, we're not Lego kits, are we? We're much more mysterious than that.
That's right. And that's why I think a Christian discussion of this, and I think, to be honest, again, that's why sometimes the pro-life, pro-choice debates are so dehumanizing and don't seem to reckon with the real human beings that are at the heart of these kind of dilemmas.
Yeah. Well, let's draw a line there and very briefly at the end of this episode tackle another question from a listener. This one came in from a listener called Aaron. And Aaron is responding to our recent episode about vaccines, the safety and efficacy thereof. And he says he found the episode very thought-provoking, as he comes from a family that's rather skeptical about these. I'm left wondering whether people who see evidence of vaccine injury would be a cause for concern, or is this simply in their head used as false evidence along the lines of correlation doesn't equal causation? While John threw out many small statistical chances of harm, we must remember there are real people behind these stats. I know a few people who claim they were negatively affected by taking the COVID vaccinations. When it becomes personal, how are we to approach the topic? I'm not so sure that being pro-vaccines would be the right approach.
Yeah, that's a very thoughtful and helpful question and comment. And I think it illustrates what we've just been talking about, doesn't it? The danger in talking about statistics and evidence and risk-benefit analysis and all that kind of stuff. We're forgetting the real human beings who agonize and suffer and worry. And I think it's just a helpful reminder that there are many people who are deeply concerned about vaccines and who may feel that they've been permanently harmed by a vaccine that they took. And how do we respond when we are trying to support and help people who might feel that? Mm. And I certainly think that it's not helpful in that individual kind of case when we're trying to support people to quote statistics, you know. Sometimes doctors try and do that, and I think it's a completely unhelpful way of addressing that. And I think, you know, I would once say the first response is to be empathic and to understand that the feelings are real, the symptoms are real, and I think to recognize and to witness and listen and accept the reality of those feelings is part of the therapy. I mean, people often their primary complaint is that health professionals, they just don't listen. They just, you know, my doctor just talks at me the whole time. And it's not helpful. No. And I think one of the things I learned in my career was that just being prepared to listen and to ask questions and to show that you care in itself is positive. Even if I have nothing to offer from a medical point of view, just by being listened to, people often feel better.
Yes, especially as I think often some of the people who are unsure about vaccines or who are convinced / taken in by some of the wilder conspiracy theories are people who already feel like the elites don't listen to them. They already might be suspicious of the good intentions of healthcare professionals and government agents. And to be, if they say, I took a vaccine and it caused me this harm, and if our response is to kind of sneer, dismiss, ignore, that only reinforces what they've already been convinced of, which is that, you know, high-flying elites don't care about the woes of ordinary people like me.
Yeah, and I think the reality of the symptoms which people feel, particularly, you know, the so-called long COVID symptoms, which are of fatigue and brain mush. And I remember, you know, in the recovery phase after COVID, having several weeks when I had those symptoms and being appalled at the intensity of the fatigue and the brain mush. And, you know, I'd have a good day and everything seemed fine. And the following day I was absolutely exhausted and flat on my back and couldn't do anything. And it was a reminder of how powerful these symptoms are. And some people, that's what they experience on a daily basis. And you know, our first response is to empathize and to listen and to recognize the reality of the symptoms. But I think that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to agree or collude with them, that all this is the result of that wretched vaccination. And if only you hadn't had that, you'd been absolutely fine. I don't think that's particularly helpful. And what I would be wanting to do is find positive responses. You know, what can I suggest? What could we do together that might help these symptoms and how to, in a positive way, to help your body to recover and to move forward, rather than going back and saying, if only, and I shouldn't have had done that. And this is one of the interesting things about litigation. It's very well known that where there is some kind of litigation about a medical accident, or even some other kind of accident, like a road traffic accident, where someone's saying, you know, I've suffered neck injury or back injury after that road accident, the very process of litigation reinforces and sometimes makes the symptoms worse. It traps people into a sort of cycle of resentment and bitterness and all the rest, which just isn't helpful.
It's almost like Jesus knew something when he taught about forgiveness being liberating and healing in itself. I guess the other thing to say is, you know, as we discussed in the episode about vaccines, there is evidence, strong scientific evidence, that some of the vaccines, including some of the ones used during COVID, have very, 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 very small but real risks of side effects. And sometimes side effects can be very severe. I mean, one of them, I think it's the mRNA vaccines, are associated with a tiny increase in the risk of myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart muscle.
The heart muscle, that's right, yeah.
And is a very serious health condition. And I also recall the AstraZeneca vaccine, which was a major part of the UK's response to COVID, is also associated with an absolutely minuscule elevated risk of serious blood clot issues, which in a handful of cases did even cause people to die. So we're never claiming that the vaccines, it's impossible that vaccines can cause injury. And even if some of these risks are in the one in a millions, which they are, given that billions of vaccine doses were issued, it is no surprise that a tiny number of people did suffer very serious vaccine injury. And the fact that you know, if you experience myocarditis, the fact that 999,999 people did not is not massively comforting to you, is it?
No, absolutely right. And but there was really very strong vaccine and surveillance going on in those early months because this was a new vaccine, nobody, very little experience. And it was precisely because of this very detailed vaccine surveillance that these rare complications were identified.
Yeah.
And certainly if somebody has a vaccine and a few days later they develop some really strange and unusual medical complication, you know, which can be diagnosed, and that would be, even today, taken very seriously, I hope. I mean, it ought to be. I mean, there are standard processes by which complications are sent into manufacturers and into the drug surveillance authorities and so on. The problem is when what's much more common is people just say, well, you know, I had a vaccine and ever since I've just felt tired, or I've been having more headaches, or I just don't have any energy. And it's these rather non-specific symptoms, which are much harder medically and biologically to tie into the vaccine itself.
And this is, I think, where a pastoral response becomes very challenging, because you want to balance truth and grace. You want to, as you said, you want to respond with empathy and compassion. You want to be incarnational, like Jesus was when he encountered people who experienced suffering of any kind. And yet at the same time, I have niggling doubts to say, you know, if someone in your life says, you know, I am convinced that the COVID vaccine caused these kind of less specific, less medically diagnosable, less kind of biologically plausible side effects, is how do you balance saying I care about your suffering, you know, I'm sorry and I'm upset that you are experiencing harm, and yet at the same time I feel quite confident from my understanding of the science and of truth that the cause is not the cause you think it is, and therefore it would not be appropriate, you know, to you know, campaign against vaccination or pursue litigation against the vaccine manufacturer or anything like this. I just think it's a very tricky pastoral position to be in as someone, if you're trying to kind of love someone through what you think is kind of a false psychogenic vaccine side effect.
Yes, and I would say, well, it's not my responsibility to try and make that all that, you know, if this person is absolutely convinced that they want to go and undertake legal procedures, I'm not going to stop them, but it's not my job to try and unpick exactly what happened. I'm not capable of doing that. I mean, even as a qualified doctor, I'm not really capable of unpicking all the various mechanisms in this one particular person. So I would want to say, let's look forward. Let's not focus on, you know, what happened here and why it happened, and if only. Let's say, okay, you have these different symptoms. What can we do positively to help? You know, a holistic approach. So, you know, as we've said before, there are physical issues, there are psychological issues, there are relation issues, there are spiritual issues. Well, here are four different categories that we can address. You know, how could we help this person's physical life, you know, to become better and more regulated and getting regular sleep and getting exercise and all the rest? And now, psychologically, what are the factors going on to help to improve your mood and to give you a greater relationally, where are your closest friends? And spiritually, are there issues going on here that we can help at a spiritual level? And it's that kind of holistic, positive approach, rather than this retrospective going back, if only it's all the problem of what happened then, which often just exacerbates and makes things worse.
Mm. And I'm slightly tentative to draw this comparison because I'm aware it will probably generate some angry emails from some listeners, but it does remind me of our conversation we had a few years ago on the podcast about ME and chronic fatigue syndrome, which I want to say up front is much less well understood and studied than some of these rare side effects from vaccines. And there is a lot that is medically and scientifically unknown about these kind of constellation of symptoms and conditions that are known as ME/CFS. However, I think there is good scientific and medical reason to believe that at least some people and some of their symptoms are not physiological, but are psychogenic or psychosomatic. As in, and the part of the reason I feel confident about that is that I have known from personal experience people who have, because they've had doctors and family members who have addressed spiritual, emotional, relational, as well as physical aspects, have seen remarkable transformation from having been effectively bedbound to returning to being able to live a normal life. Not because people dismiss their symptoms as fake or accuse them of malingering or hypochondria, but because people listened carefully and said, rather than endlessly searching for this one mysterious virus that might have caused these symptoms, how can we look forward and say, are there things we can do right here and now to address your holistic health in all those four spheres that might enable you to start to get out of bed and to find more energy and feel able to move forward from some of these debilitating symptoms that you're experiencing? And I know people for whom that approach has been transformational.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it has to be said that the whole phenomenon of long COVID, where there are absolutely raised inflammatory markers, various sort of strange ways that this virus has activated inflammatory and autoimmune processes in the body, and yet produces symptoms that are very similar to chronic fatigue syndrome and so on, has led to new scientific interest in all this area. And of course, there may well be some physical inflammatory processes. It doesn't have to be that in all cases it is purely of the mind. There may well be physical processes, but they're not only physical. Because we are these complex holistic beings, there are always going to be psychological, relational, spiritual elements. And I think that positively, that gives the Christian practitioner, even just the Christian friend, as well as the Christian health professional, it gives us a whole armory of positive ways of addressing. You know, we are not completely devoid of therapeutic and positive ways of supporting one another. And just, you know, listening, spending time together, encouraging people, addressing these four different areas together. It's my experience too, I think, you know, and within my own journey, I've often experienced that there are wonderful therapeutic potential. And the other thing to say is that by creation, our bodies have this intrinsic therapeutic, restorative, extraordinary creative potential, if only we can prevent the damaging and negative effects of so much of modern life.
All right, well, we've been going for over an hour now, so let's probably wrap that one up. Thank you so much to our two questioners, Aaron and Ben, for those really fascinating questions. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what we've been talking about, both on this question about vaccine harm, but also our early discussion about abortion laws, pregnancy, brain death, life support, competing interests, legal personhood for fetuses, so much to get your teeth into. So please do get in touch to share your own thoughts, disagreements, your challenge, your further questions. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. And you can also find lots of interesting resources on lots of these topics on Dad's website if you're interested in more things to read and listen to stimulate your thinking. That's johnwyatt.com. So you can find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. And I particularly encourage you to sign up to my weekly church news newsletter for free, which is called The Critical Friend. You can also find links to that on my website. Thanks so much for listening and being with us on Matters of Life and Death this week. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Keeping your IT team sharp isn't optional, it's essential. CBT Nuggets delivers high-quality IT training led by real-world experts who know what teams actually need on systems teams will actually use. Whether it's staying current on cloud, networking, or security, CBT Nuggets makes training simple, effective, and scalable. No fluff, no wasted time, just smarter, faster IT teams. Thousands of companies trust CBT Nuggets, and yours can too. Go to cbtnuggets.com/solutions and start training today.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.